Welcome to the Global Marketing Show, the podcast for all things international business. I'm your host, Wendy Pease, president of Rapport International and a translation expert. Come along with me today as we talk to an expert in the global marketing world about facing their biggest fears, hearing about mistakes they made or saw, discussing best practices, and sharing fun travel language and culture stories. Welcome to the Global Marketing Show. I'm so glad to have you here. We're going to talk with somebody today who is really an expert on importing and exporting, and she works with a specific type of client. So we're going to get to that. But before we do, I just want to remind you that the Global Marketing Show is sponsored by Rapport International, who connects you to anyone anywhere in the world in over 200 languages by providing high-quality written translation and spoken interpretation services. They're known for their tidbits on social media, and they're putting all sorts of information about languages and cultures out. So I have a tidbit to share for you, and it's about Spanish and saying ahorita. Ahorita in Mexico means right now, like we're going to do it right now. It's in a little bit of time, but let's do it right now. But in the Caribbean, when you're speaking Spanish and you say it, it means we're going to do it in a little bit. So not at this immediate moment. So when an expert from Rapport International is doing translation, they need to understand different cultures and how they use the language. So, but ahorita, we'll do it right now, the Mexican way of jump into introducing Kim Daniels. So first off, Kim, welcome and thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. You've got an impressive background. You're CEO and you're an international trade specialist that focuses on the needs of businesses when it comes to their import and export actions. You've got a master's in business and a master's in law, and you've got years of experience in the industry. You've been a customs broker since 2013, and you handle all the government paperwork that is required. God bless you for doing that. You also provide candid consultings, diving into the regulations that are changing all the time to ensure that clients are compliant as the laws continue to change. It's your focus to be aware of everything happening in the government in trade activities and keep your clients informed. Well, that is absolutely fantastic. That's a lot of details to keep track of.
And yeah, we don't memorize anything in this field.
Don't memorize it. How come?
It changes. It'll change tomorrow. As soon as I memorize it, it'll change.
Right. So you've got books and books and books to look up, but we'll get to that. First off, in your company, you specialize in working with other companies that have less than 50 employees and about $5 million in revenue or under. Tell me, why are you focusing on companies this size?
So those companies we've defined as the micro business. And micro businesses tend to have fewer resources and less, I guess, less gumption when it comes to exporting and getting their goods out in the rest of the world. A lot of people need to remember that only 4% of the global population is in the United States. So 96% of the buying public is actually outside of these borders. So depending on your product, it might look really good to go ahead and look at exporting that product. It'll help your bottom line. It's much more market share. You can sell to nearshore areas such as the Caribbean, like Turks and Caicos, the Bahamas. You could try to go a little further offshore. So Europe, Africa, depending on what your product is, there's a market for it outside of the United States. All you have to do is explore it.
If you're a company that size, there's still so much of a market in the United States. Why would you recommend that they look at exporting so early in their life?
So it kind of depends, like I said, on the product. You know, sometimes their product could be saturated in the United States. So one of the things to look at is, you know, what other products are very similar to yours that other people are buying, especially if they're not buying yours. So it's not just about improvement, it's also market share. So if your market is, you know, only in the United States, then you're actually cutting yourself off from the rest of the market that you could be accessing. So for example, let's say you make swimsuits in the United States and you're focused in, let's say, California. You could expand that market to other places such as the Bahamas or Turks and Caicos and other Caribbean areas where you could actually gain some market share by being in other places where swimsuits would be, you know, highly valued. And especially depending on the design and the style and, you know, what the current mode is when it comes to swimsuits, if you're selling only in, you know, a few states in the US or even all the states in the US, you can still expand your market by looking offshore and sending your stuff to other locations.
Really good point. Because if you're selling swimsuits in California, if you go to North Dakota or Michigan or other places in the United States, the demand for swimsuits is going to be way less than going to a smaller country
right,
that lives the beach year round.
Right.
Or vacation.
Don't forget, yeah. There's a logistical issue. I know everybody likes to purchase their stuff on Amazon these days or other, you know, fulfillment areas online, but those services don't necessarily get to the Caribbean islands, or at least not as timely as they would within the mainland. So if you can send a gross of your product to Turks and Caicos, you can sell them faster than someone would be able to receive it from, you know, trying to use an online sales method.
Interesting. Now, a lot of consumer goods are going to e-commerce. Like it's a big thing to do e-commerce, because you could do it everywhere. But you're actually saying you might be able to sell more by selling a bulk down to a place. Talk me through more of that, is how somebody would decide to do e-commerce versus what you're exporting.
Well, it doesn't have to be an either or. You can absolutely do a diversification of your market, you know, and exactly how you send your goods out. So if you are sending to another country and you're working within there's of course some struggle when you're working within confines of their laws and how, you know, what their tariffs are and those sort of things. But typically, especially with tourist type goods, they're not difficult to get into those areas because those areas that are, you know, developed based on tourism. But if you diversify and you say, okay, I'm going to sell, you know, to this segment of the market via e-commerce, and then I'm also going to go direct to market and, you know, through the retail chains in, you know, those other countries, then you're looking at being able to kind of see what works and test different methods. So if you're testing out your e-commerce, like you said, you know, somebody in North Dakota may not want to, you know, purchase that teeny tiny bikini unless going to, you know, a Caribbean island because, you know, there's got to be that place to wear it, right? So wherever it's cold, they may not want it as readily. But once they get there, if they've forgotten it or they forgot to order it or it didn't come in time, they're going to get on vacation. They're not going to have that teeny tiny bikini that they wanted. So they can go to the store and obviously buy it. But you want to make sure that they're seeing your product. So if they saw it, you know, online and they know that they can buy it when they get there, that helps you as well. So it's diversifying your market share.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Plus, so it's not only the need if they forgot, but people have more time and they're spending money on vacation. So maybe they need that other one. Can you give us an example of a company that you've worked with that's done this well?
There was a company a while ago, I want to say, gosh, several years ago, that was making swimsuits in the United States. And I had them look into exporting that swimsuit to other places, and especially with some of the free trade agreements that we have. And I focus a lot on the Caribbean and Mexico when it comes to that sort of market, because we do have free trade agreements. So by use of that free trade agreement, the receiving country has to break down some of the barriers of, you know, the sending country when that free trade agreement is in. It works both directions, right? So for example, in the Bahamas, we have a free trade agreement. So when the Bahamas is receiving, you know, retail goods, they have less stringent requirements than somebody who's importing, say, from Asia. So this can be very helpful both directions. But the company that I helped before, yeah, they looked into that and they end up actually quite expanding about 30% of their sales just because they started looking in those markets where they could sell their goods directly and still keep their e-commerce store open as well.
So the swimsuit example was a real live example. It wasn't a hypothetical. This is why it's important to do. That's fantastic. Okay, so it certainly can open markets, but what are some of the challenges that people face or fears that they have when they first come to you?
Well, it depends on what they're coming to me for. So I am not an attorney, and I tell people that all the time. But if I feel like you need one, I have one who helps me out from time to time. So I'm happy to send you over. But for the most part, most of my clientele comes over and they say, hey, you know, I want to start importing. I want to bring in, let's say, tobacco from South America. What do I need to do? And so I walk them through this process of what it is to import. For those who are looking to export, I kind of more offer a 1 hour session, general discussion for free that lets them know, okay, here's some links that you can go to kind of analyze your market and figure out where is the best place for your specific product. Flip-flops, swimsuits, those kinds of things. Obviously, you want to go towards more warm places that are very tourist-centric. But if you're, you know, if you're selling, you know, big heavy coats, maybe we go towards like Canada or places that are colder, that we also have, you know, some free trade agreements. You can start expanding and you can expand small. And what I try to do is, you know, if you're going to, you know, fail forward, right? Fail forward, fail fast. Figure out that small market that's going to work for your specific product that is close to you. This will keep your costs down. It'll allow you to prove your concept, and then you can expand from there. So for example, if your goods do really well in the Bahamas, maybe you expand out to Turks and Caicos. If they do really well there, maybe you go to Aruba. You know, those kinds of things that you can say, okay, it did really well here. I can start island hopping, right? So that's why I talk to my clients. They come to me and they're like, I want to expand. Not really sure how to get my stuff out. I walk them through the process of what that looks like. You do not need a customs broker to export your goods. There is a way to do it online. And as long as you can devote the time to it, it's completely free. If you hire a customs broker to do it, they're going to charge you a service fee. That's how we keep our lights on and make, you know, keep our dogs fed and that sort of thing, right? So it's the same sort of thing, is that if you want the help, I give a 1 hour session. I let you know, okay, here's how you do this. Here's how you expand your market. And then if you're wanting to explore those markets even more, I introduce you to people I know at the Commerce Department, and they help you with that export process. And they help get you the information that you need within that destination country. So if you are working with the Trade Department and they say, okay, we have a trade mission in the Caribbean, like for example, they do have one coming up at the end of October. They have a Caribbean trade mission. You can go there. It's being held in Miami this year. And you can say, okay, and meet with different, some government officials, but some companies who get signed up for it as well. And then find out, okay, who can I work with there so that my goods get accepted, so that I don't have any delays, so that I can take advantage of the free trade agreement because I make these goods in the US, that sort of thing. So I kind of help guide people towards the direction they need to go. And then when it starts building and building, that's when they tend to hire someone to just do it for them, because it's more work than they have time for. And that's when they outsource the actual export paperwork part of it.
Paperwork, how is that done?
It's actually done through a government website called the ACE portal. And so you sign up, you get, you know, you go through all the parameters of signing up, which can take about an hour, depending on, you know, the background of your business. And then you basically, every single time that you have an export that needs to go out, you get a code assigned to it. That's something I also provide. You assign that code, and then you fill out the paperwork, and then you print it out and you send it with your freight forwarder, and it just goes. If it's going as freight, if it's going as parcel, like FedEx, UPS, DHL size products, then you can just basically send it. So you can send a whole box of teeny tiny bikinis through the FedEx process, and they'll take care of all of that for you. So it really kind of depends on what the scope and size of your target market is. If you're sending big bulky items, it's better to use a freight forwarder, use a customs broker to get that paperwork done correctly, so you don't have a lot of delays or lags.
Okay. And so you go to do the paperwork and you go to ACE and it takes an hour.
But just for the first setup. Once you're set up, then it takes about 10 to 15 minutes approximately. You can build a template in it, which is really nice. So you can just build a template. And if you're selling the same product to the same location every single time, you can just use that template over and over again and make the slight modifications for that day and, you know, size of shipment.
So is it really fairly easy to do the paperwork?
Yeah. Once you get used to it, I mean, it's a learning curve, but once you learn it, yeah, it can be pretty easy.
Bunch of different classifications, and you'd need to pick out the right classification for your product.
And that's where you come to somebody like me and you get that, you know, get that hour consulting and, you know, say, hey, you know, I'm sending out teeny tiny bikinis. They're made of cotton. It's, you know, knitted cotton. Where does, you know, where do we look at? And so we assign what's called a Schedule B or an HTS code. And then we also assign an ECCN number, which in the case of bikinis would just be EAR 99 because it's not controlled. So anything that's controlled, so think like drones, for example, many drones are controlled. So they go under an ECCN number, but there are some things that are like just toys and those would go under EAR 99. So it takes someone that's an expert in the field who can understand what your product is and then can assign the right code for it. Cause you definitely don't want to violate anything because export laws are cranky if you do it wrong.
Cranky. That's a way to say it. So what happens if you do it? Okay. And so what I understand is that the book of codes is humongous. And so The rest of the paperwork is easy, but that's the one thing you have to get accurate. So you call up Kim and you say, okay, help me pick out the code. How many codes are there and what happens if you get it wrong?
There are a lot of codes. I don't know the exact number, but it's thousands and thousands and thousands. There are, you know, there's a lot of ECCN codes as well. So again, depending on your product, that's where we kind of go through and use our expertise to know kind of where to find the information as opposed to where to just, you know, picking one out of the air. You can't do that. You have to know how the codes work. There's some very specific guidance at the beginning of each chapter and each section that tells you, like, for example, electric blankets do not fall in the electrics chapter. They fall in the blankets chapter. So it's those kinds of things. But the if you get it wrong, it just depends on a lot. So if you get caught and you did it wrong without malice or trying to get away with something, usually you'll get a fine, maybe a slap on the wrist. Don't do that again. You know, that kind of thing. If your product is controlled, you will get a much larger fine. There is a case that happened, and I'm not going to name any company names, but the company was exporting military grade products and their ITAR department was not exactly up to the level it should have been. And that company got fined over $30 million. So yeah, it can be very, very problematic if you don't do it right. And especially if it's an egregious oversight and consistent culture within your company to basically snub your nose at the government, you're going to get caught and you're going to get fined and you could get shut down to where you're no longer allowed to export anymore.
Wow. Okay. So you got to get it right. And how can you show the government that you're working on getting it right when, I mean, your codes could be just slightly off or it could be finding something in, you know, the electronics and not the blanket.
Well, and that's where you talk to somebody like me, like, you know, someone who knows that electric blankets don't fall in the electrics chapter, right? Because it says specifically at the very beginning, section 1A, this does not cover electric blankets, right? So we know where not to look, right? But mostly it's, you know, if you get it slightly wrong or you're off by a couple of digits, because it's a 10-digit code, as long as it was just an honest mistake and you can prove that you didn't know any better, or your broker did it wrong or something, typically you can mitigate any kind of problems away from that. And you learn from it. And as long as you go forward doing things correctly, the government will be like, okay, you didn't know, you fixed it, you fixed the problem, you're fine. But if you continuously do it, if you have years where you haven't made sure your ITAR program is on, and ITAR is the International Trade in Arms Regulations, International Traffic in Arms Regulations. There's a lot of acronyms in what I do, keeping them strictly complicated.
Yes.
And so, you know, if you don't do right by those particular laws, and it's constant and consistent and, you know, almost like inherent to your business, yeah, you're getting shut down and you're getting fined, and it's possible someone can go to jail. So, because basically you violated, you know, military laws as well. So there's military grade products that have to be scrutinized before you can send them to places. And you have to make sure that those places that you're sending them to aren't sending them on to other places that we are not friendly with, right? So there's this whole kind of a web where everybody looks into what you're doing. Swimsuits, consumer products, not a big deal. Big military drones, problem.
Okay. Right. So there's a pretty clear line there, you know, consumer products versus military, and that we could probably all pretty much guess.
Yeah. Sometimes the complications usually come down to electronics, like the motherboards and, you know, those kinds of things where it's processing boards that can lead to other problems. So if you're on the cusp and you're like, well, I mean, we use this in cameras, but the cameras could be attached to aircraft, then you need to say, let's just have someone look at it. It doesn't cost a lot, you know, just have a broker look at it. Their consulting fees aren't usually like going to break the bank, and they can look at it. They can analyze it. They can tell you if it's controlled or not. And it's worth the money to just let someone look at it if you don't have an expert on staff.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Now, what kind of industries do you work across?
Well, since I represent mostly micro businesses, everything. I have importers of mealworms. I have importers of t-shirts. I have importers of auto parts. So just a myriad of different things. Like I said, tobacco. Actually, I have importers of cigars. And, you know, there's a lot of different laws when it comes to tobacco. The only thing I don't touch on is anything to do with alcohol, because it's a very, very specialized, nuanced focus. And for that, I always tell them, go to an alcohol importer. Like, you have to go to somebody that focuses on that. And there's this whole gambit of things that have to happen when you're importing alcohol, including wine. And it breaks my heart that I can't do it.
Yes, we love that wine.
Right. But there's, you know, most of the time, you know, it's mostly consumer goods that I help to import, and I handle the paperwork for exporting. There's the craft beer is one of those exports that I've been working to try to break into. So exporting alcohol is not nearly as complicated as importing alcohol. So if you can get the conduit set up between, say, here and England is a huge, huge fan of craft beer. They absolutely love American craft beer. And so whenever they can receive it, they sell out just as quickly as they get it. And there are companies that can help you. If you do have a craft beer, put it in a vat, and then you basically send the whole vat over, and then they do bottling there. So what this does is it reduces the weight, so you can send more product. And then when it gets there, you can it and bottle it within England, and then they sell it that way. And I work with a customs broker in England who helps to facilitate this kind of trade.
Okay. So if you have a craft beer company, you should definitely reach out to Kim Daniels right now, because she's got a market for you.
Right.
Okay, I'm trying to wrap my head around something. We were talking about, like, if you want to do the export paper, you go online and you have to know your number, and the rest of it you should be able to do. So that's the one side of it. Now you're talking about importers. So is there more paperwork to do when you export, or what is it, the paperwork that you're doing for the importers when they're bringing goods into the U.S.?
So when you export, you have an ITN number that you get. So you basically get this confirmation sheet from ACE that tells you the ITN number. So it's basically saying it's cleared through the exporting system. And then you give that to whoever's moving the freight, right? For importing, we have to go through kind of a myriad of different things. It's not as complicated as it sounds, but there are a couple of forms that have to be filed. One is a 7501. So that is basically your entry summary that says how much taxes or duties you owe to the US government based on what you're importing, right? And a lot of people are like, let's do complete free trade. And I am a free trade advocate, except for one thing. A full free trade means that all U.S. citizens' taxes increase. So when I first got my customs broker license, which was a while ago, about 60% of federal expenses were covered by duties for goods coming in the port. And when we added the Section 301, that increased substantially. But it, because of COVID, Section 301 was a 25% duties on, on Chinese goods. And so all of that money goes into the general fund, which funded the COVID packages. So when importers were importing products, that 25% extra they were paying for Chinese-based goods or Chinese-originating goods went into the general fund, and then it got redistributed into COVID relief packages. Yep, wealth redistribution. That's exactly what it is.
Wealth redistribution. Wait a minute. So why are you in favor of free trade agreements if the duties on goods coming into the U.S. cover?
That's why I say I'm mostly in favor, except for that. There's a lot of studies that say that the more open trade you have, the better your economy is. So the World Trade Organization, I believe, put out a study some years ago, and actually different countries, their own governments have put out studies that show the more open your trade, the better your economy does. And so that's where I'm kind of in favor of it. But I think that there's a nice little medium area where, yes, you can still protect your industries, right? So we have a pretty high duty on cotton goods. Cotton t-shirts, I think, are 17.6% in duty. And so that's a pretty high duty. Some overcoats are 32%. So it kind of depends on the, from what I've been able to gather, because some of it's really no rhyme or reason, but some of it is we're trying to protect our own industry. But some of it is it's just cost that much because it always has, and no one bothered to look at it and say, what are we protecting if there's nothing here, right? So that's some of the duties. I think that there can be a happy medium. I do not agree with Section 301. I never have. It was never going to work, and it was going to cost those micro businesses disproportionately. And that's where I was pushing against the U.S. government at the time, saying, look, these don't work. And the reason being is because you're trying to fix a culture by being a bully, and it doesn't work that way. And in fact, there have been plenty of studies that show, and I just read it in Foreign Affairs last week, that punitive damages such as, the Section 301s, trying to force a country to change doesn't work. Trying to force a country to stop, such as the sanctions against Russia, does work, or has been shown to work in the past. So you have to be really careful with how you use sanctions and how you use Section 301, because who are you really harming? And in the case of Section 301, you're really harming American businesses and American consumers. In the case of sanctions against Russia, you're harming Russia and some collateral damage to the buying public.
Okay, so take that down to a next level. Which part works? Because you said that the sanctions don't work. Like, if we have sanctions against Russia right now, you're hurting the Russians.
Right.
So you don't agree with that, or you?
No, I do. I do. Okay. Because I do think it should work, depending. I mean, again, you're dealing with personalities and you're dealing with culture. So, but because a lot of other countries got together, right? So you got European countries who got together and applied these same sanctions that the United States did, right? So that actually has a curbing effect, according to the study I read. As for the Section 301 sanctions against China, where they added the 25% duty on lists 1, 2, and 3, and then 15 or 7.5% on 4A, those don't work, and they're not able to work, because you can't change a culture that doesn't understand what you're asking for. And when you're saying, hey, I need you to recognize intellectual property, well, you're talking about culture that doesn't understand what that means to recognize it, right? So, and they just, it just doesn't, their head doesn't wrap around it. So you're trying to force them by bullying them on money that they're not even paying.
Okay, I see. So Russian sanctions, you're doing something we don't like. It's very clear. Whereas if you try to sanction something that the culture just doesn't get,
right,
then it's not going to work.
Right.
Because it's just so unclear. Yeah.
In fact, our trade deficit with China today is worse than it was in 2018 when these Section 301s came into place.
Yeah.
It's a complete opposite effect.
Opposite effect. And you look at companies that are exporting to China when they did the, mm-hmm. you know, the trade taxes on our companies, then the our exports dropped. So
absolutely,
it just hurt both countries.
Yeah, and it does. And that's the fallout that you're looking at. So, you know, whenever they use 232, they use 301, they need to remember, who are we harming? Because if there's, I can tell you as a customs broker, there's no mechanism in place for any country to pay duties on behalf of an importer, at least not in our system. So the importer has to pay it. Oh, and by the way, you also have to sign an affidavit that says you're not being reimbursed for this, especially with anti-dumping and countervailing. So who are you hurting?
Right.
And the whole idea is to get them to move away from that particular market. That's the idea. But when your landed costs are still less than trying to source domestically, they're still less.
Yeah.
You're still saving money.
Yeah. Right. So landed costs would be all the costs, the taxes, the duties, the shipment, and the product costs are less for importing than if you had it produced here in the United States. So then it's worth. Yeah.
And case in point, I actually, when they first came into play, I had a very small startup. They had, you know, they had just had this very strict budget on what they were doing because they got just a little bit of money to be able to do it. And they ended up with a $2,000 duty they weren't expecting because it came into effect as their stuff was on the water. Go figure. And so they ended up paying landed and delivery $11,000. But the same product, because we were looking to see if we could get them an exception, found the same product in the U.S., it was $15,000. Not delivered.
Wait, what was the difference in price?
$4,000 was the difference in price. So if
so
they bought
even with
the US,
this additional cost that hit them while they were on the ocean, they still were saving money by importing the products.
Yes.
Yeah.
So the American market has to become more competitive if we're going to, you know, be a resource for anybody, and we're just not. And we you know, I mean, we have demands for high wages, and I get it. I totally would love a high wage too. I run this company, so they don't pay me the big bucks.
but you have, you know, potential.
There's potential. It's the hope. But we have, you know, but it's you know, we have this talent pool that is, you know, demanding very high wages. And I get it. I totally, you know, respect what the ask is, but there has to be some kind of mediation here, because if we're so expensive, no one buys from us, we're shooting ourselves in the foot.
Right. Right. Yeah. It's a continual balancing thing, especially right now when we're having trouble hiring people in the United States.
Yeah.
So what, we're coming to the end of our time. What recommendations would you give to companies on exporting from the US or importing into the US?
First, I would say, remember that it's a holistic process, right? So the whole thing kind of works in congruence with each other. So we have a very large textile industry. We export a lot of cotton and we export it to Asia, and then Asia turns it into, let's say, t-shirts, and then they come back to the United States as imports. This is holistic. You want this, because without the imports, you don't have the exports. Right. The other thing I would say is look into foreign trade zones. So in some ways, depending on your product and where it comes from, you can set up a foreign trade zone and you can finalize production of certain goods into the final product, and it can go out of the foreign trade zone as a U.S. built good, depending on the percentage of value in the build. Right. A company, I'm sure you've all heard of it, Mercedes. Toyota, a lot of car companies take advantage, Honda, I think too, take advantage of the foreign trade zone, and they can bring in the goods from all over the world into the FTZ, build the car, and the car goes out at 2.4% as the whole value, not as the value of individual pieces, right? So it builds jobs, it creates more jobs here, which is very good, and it lowers their tax burden when it goes into the U.S. commerce. In some respects, this can work really well until Section 301 is, you know, finished and they decide to go ahead and cancel it. It doesn't really work with Chinese originating goods. There's a whole complicated web that has to be done that I'm not going to get into because it'll take a lot longer. But just suffice it to say that in the past, it's been really good to have a foreign trade zone. If you're a small business and you want to, you know, you want to look at the foreign trade zone, look at, you know, get a feasibility study. I work with somebody who does those, and we actually can do a feasibility study for you, assess your products, decide what the duties are going to be if you import them into the FTZ, which means that you're suspending having to pay those duties until they go into commerce. That can be very, very helpful for your cash flow. But if just suspending it isn't enough, but it looks like we might be able to do what's called a duty inversion, and your goods, like the car, goes out at 2.4%, that can be helpful too. So we always recommend, if it leans towards it, if you have the wherewithal to at least do a feasibility study, definitely get that done and look into your operations and how we can make things a little more efficient and save you some money.
Wow. Okay. So if anybody's listening to this that's interested in importing and exporting and the paperwork and the governments have got you confused, then definitely reach out to Kim or Kimberly Daniels, as you'll find her on, well, you're Kim Daniels on LinkedIn. Yeah. Okay. So we end every episode with, what's your favorite foreign word?
Schadenfreude. I never say it right. Schadenfreude.
Yes. Tell us what it means and why it's your favorite word.
So it's like frenemy. And it's my favorite word because a lot of times, especially in trade, you can find some very good friends, but you can also find some frenemies.
And Schadenfreude is like a frenemy.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I've also heard explained as like laughing at somebody else's mistakes or misfortune. Yes,
yeah. Yeah, like, you know, a friend of mine and I go running and she trips. I'm going to point and laugh at her. I'll help her up, but I'm going to point and laugh at her.
Right.
I'm not completely like destroyed.
There you go. Your nice German word. Well, Kim, where can people reach you?
They can always reach out to my website, www.mlitinc.com. And then they can email me directly at kdaniels@mlitinc.com as well. And then, of course, LinkedIn.
Okay. So say a little bit slower.
mlitinc.com.
Okay. So did you get that? That stands for Mercantile Logistics and International Trade. So mlitinc.com. And correct. So if you have questions, take her up on that hour for free. She's a wealth of information. My brain was having trouble keeping up here. So I really appreciate you being here, Kim, and talking this through.
I love when people ask me questions. It gives me a chance to just get it out of my head.
Good. We'll share it around. All right, listeners, if you like this or you have questions, reach out to Kim directly. Kim Daniels, you can find her on LinkedIn, or you can go to the Facebook group called Global Marketing and Growth and post your questions there to see who else might be able to give their personal experience on doing importing and exporting. If you know somebody that would be a good guest, you can certainly send them to rapporttranslations.com and just go to the search bar and type in podcast, and there's an application on there. So thank you so much for listening, and we'll be back at you next time with the next episode.
That's a wrap for this session. A big thanks to you for listening to the Global Marketing Show. Hope you had just as much fun as I did. New sessions launch weekly on all places you find podcasts, Apple, Spotify, Google Play, and of course on our website. If you know someone interested in this topic, please tell them about us. Au revoir for now.